You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name's David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with somebody I've known for, how many years?
14.
Since you were 14. And I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but you might tell me, but you've got to be close to 40. Oh, 41. Wow.
Yep.
Wow. We know each other a long time.
Yes, indeed.
How come you look the same and I don't?
I don't know how that works. I like to think I'm older, though.
Yeah. Wow, that's wild. So I met Sophia when she applied to the school that I was at the time trying to get off the ground and we've known each other. We've stayed in touch. We've known each other for years. Ultimately, Sophia graduated from Berkeley, came to work at the school, and has been there for, well, how many years?
17 years now.
17 years. Wow. And is both a teacher. I know for a while you were a curriculum coordinator or head of curriculum or something for the Spanish
department. Yeah, now I'm department chair.
Now you're department chair as of recent, like, were you recently?
As of this year.
As of this year. Great.
As of, well, technically I start next year.
You mean the year coming. Got it.
Yes.
Got it. Well, so we're going to have a really frank conversation because that's the only conversation. Those are the only conversations I've ever had with Sophia. And, you know, I'll say to the audience, but I'm saying to you, Sophia, I learned more. Well, you were the first person to actually open my eyes to the entire, open my eyes to how much I didn't understand about disability and ability and the assumptions that people make, that I was making, that I make, based on sort of colloquial cultural misunderstanding, and not at any rate, you know. So we're going to have a frank conversation, and if I ask you questions you don't want to answer, or if you go to a territory and I'm going to say don't talk about that. But that's probably not going to happen, knowing you. So thank you for coming on to Curiosity Invited, and thanks for doing this, and thanks for being willing to have a conversation about, you know, look, what I have mixed feelings about is, so I know you to be an incredibly competent human being, and I'm going to give a little bit of your bio. I'll put it in the description, but I'll give a little bit of your bio so that other people can get a sense. But here we are. We could talk about all sorts of things. You have points of view. You have knowledge. You have expertise in all sorts of things, and here we are again. People want to talk to you and want you to be willing to talk about ability, disability, et cetera. So that's ironic because you're way more than that. And yet somehow you are also that. And
I'm okay with, and I know that is what I've centered in on in a lot of my educational, even though I've been an educator for more than 20 years now, because I started my educational journey in college as a teacher, I, going into it, knew that regardless of what subject I was teaching, the disability was going to be part of the teaching moments. Because regardless of whether I'm teaching teacher preparation in college or Spanish, the disability is never away from my frame of reference and from my students' frame of reference. Like, regardless of who I'm teaching, the fact that I am not your traditional teacher, because I can't be a traditional teacher, I can't be the teacher or the professor who writes things on the board and just has them copy things that I write, because my writing sucks. Because I can't reach the board, because I can't. So I've, in any context, the disability is going to take full focus. And because of that, I've been okay with always talking about how my disability affects my life. Because it does.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember one time, you know, there was a, and maybe it's still there, but there was a period where people were normally able, I don't even know how to use the words, right? Regular folks, people without an obvious disability,
yeah,
were using language like differently abled. And
oh, God.
I remember one time you said to me, it was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm disabled. Like, yeah, we're differently able. That's true. But like, this is moving through the world the way I move through the world is a disability.
I still cringe when people use words like handicapable, and like, I get what they're trying to do. They're trying to normalize it. They're trying to be, but, and I still agree with this person first language, like person with a disability and things like that, because it shouldn't be the first thing somebody thinks about when they see me. But I also acknowledge that it is such a central focus of who I am that not acknowledging that is also a disservice. So when people try to normalize it in a way where it kind of detracts from it, also drives me crazy.
Right.
Because it is important to, and that's me and my personal preference, that somebody else might say to you, I love when people don't use the word disabled and maybe uses a more positive, if you will, frame of reference, because for them that's what makes them comfortable. So it's all, here is where I always tell people when I'm doing trainings about disability awareness and disability and inclusive practice, I always say, you have to take your cue from the person that you're talking to. You can't assume that somebody is going to like the term disabled person or person with a disability. It's really up to them.
Well, I get that. And, you know, we're living at a time where so many things are so highly politicized. And so you may be comfortable with it, but I guarantee you that there will be people leaving comments that you know, try to rake me over the coals because I referred to you as someone with a disability, even though you're fine with it And in fact, you just said you prefer the acknowledgement of that. And yet there's an intolerance that is linguistic, for sure. Right? Right. I mean, that is, you use the wrong word. So we live at a really weird time.
And that's why my advice to anyone when they're dealing with sensitive language is really, it depends on the person you're talking to. So not being afraid to acknowledge, like, hey, so how would you like me to refer to you in context?
Right.
Like, and acknowledging that there is that language that you're willing to talk to the person in the way that they are comfortable is the best way to do it.
So lest anyone listening to this think that Sophia is only about that, let me just tell you. So after high school, which she graduated from, she went off to Berkeley, got a degree in political science with minors in Spanish and disability studies. She went on to earn a master's degree in secondary education and a doctoral degree in educational leadership for social justice, both from Loyola Marymount University. So you're speaking to somebody, or I'm speaking to somebody, or you're listening to somebody with substantial background and experience in the world of education, and in the practice of teaching. So she is not just a theoretician, nothing wrong with that, by the way, but actually has years and years of experience in the classroom, and even more years of experience in a wheelchair. So would you be comfortable talking about, well, like, why are you in a wheelchair? What's the deal?
I was born, I was supposed to be born on Christmas Day, and I was born on October 8th. So I was born a few months premature. And when I was born, I was only 3 pounds. And so because of the lack of oxygen during my birth, I was at 6 months old or so. Can't remember the exact time I should diagnosed with cerebral palsy, because my parents started to notice that I was not developing my fine motor skills and things like that. So they went to various doctors, and eventually I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. My father and my mother, my father being a professor, was very determined from a very young age that my education and my mind was going to be what was going to be my way of proving to folks that I was not someone to be pitied. So I thank both of my parents every single day for that drive, because that is really what has got me to the point of where I am today, and why I value education from the very outset. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that, because my cerebral palsy did not affect my in that way. So I was able to pursue education, and I'm lucky in that context. Mm-hmm. For sure.
And I know you went off to Berkeley after high school. Well, I don't know if it makes any sense for you, you know, but I remember that there was that you were at a public school before, somewhere in San Fernando Valley, And it was not a pleasant experience.
It was definitely not a pleasant experience.
It was almost like you were too much trouble.
The school that I was in for high school was really just not physically accessible. The straw that broke the camel's back, for lack of a better phrase, I was physically injured at the school, and I from that moment forward was not ever going to step foot in the school again.
Right.
And that is how we ended up in your school at the time.
I mean, when you said you were physically injured, it wasn't a hostile act by somebody attacking you. It was, as I recall, an aide that you were given that didn't know what he was doing.
She didn't know what she was doing. She was helping me transfer, and I subsequently broke my femur.
Right, that's right.
And I was out of commission for 2 months.
Right.
And the first 2 months of neuro, I didn't even go to school because I was unable to sit.
Right.
In my chair.
Right.
So that is what I can now look back on and say the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, because it really forced me to change course and start valuing my education again, because I was really in a space where I didn't want anything to do with anyone, and I was pretty depressed and almost suicidal. Really, at that point, having people who didn't automatically judge me because I was in a chair gave me the freedom to really be a teenager, really just not feel like I was going to get constantly bullied for being just me. Mm-hmm. And so then that kind of gave me the confidence to start really thinking about what I wanted to do with myself, and really wanted to pursue other things, and ultimately that's what led me to Berkeley.
When did the idea come to you that you the education was your future, not in terms of learning, but in terms of actually teaching, being in a classroom, all of that stuff, career? When did that come?
Well, in Berkeley, I became very involved with the disability community, because Berkeley in the 1970s was the birthplace of the disability rights movement.
Yes.
So through that, I started to really become proud of my disability and proud of the struggles that had come before me. And I really became immersed in this idea of the disability is not a detraction of who I am, but it's part of me, and I should be proud of it. So that was the moment where I discovered, for lack of a better word, this idea of disability being such a focal point in my life. And part of that was that my friends and I decided to teach a student-run class once a week for fellow students. It's a program that Berkeley had at that moment, and I believe still has, called Democratic Education at Cal. And we develop curriculum for students to become personal care attendants for folks with disabilities. And so they, at the same time as they were helping individuals with disabilities and being paid for it, but they were also coming to our class once a week, and we were telling them about the history of the disability rights movement. We were inviting speakers and the like, and that's when I really got bit by the teaching bug, because I started to realize, like, these classmates of mine had no idea of the rich history that Berkeley had in and of itself for the disability rights movement. And even though it was really great to see so many people with disabilities on Berkeley campus, and it had always been kind of a mecca for students with disabilities, I think giving people the opportunity to understand why that was something that I was really proud of.
But can we just switch tracks for a second?
When
you meet people for the first time, back then and now, well, you said it, right? I mean, your disability is in some ways not only from the choice of what you have engaged in and the business you started, et cetera, and the work that you've done in the disability rights movement, but you're sitting in a chair. And so it's there. And is it a source of frustration? I mean, obviously, people react to it in different ways.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, could you talk about that? Does it tend to be hard? Do you feel like you have to do things to put people at ease? Or how does that work?
It is a sense, I don't know if I would call it frustration, but when I see people's demeanor change when I walk into a room, it's something that I unfortunately had to deal with for so long that it kind of rolls on my back at this point. Mm-hmm. And I automatically have to, like, start giving people my resume, for lack of a better word, so that they start understanding that they're not just talking to anybody, but that I have a right to be in the space and have an opinion. And
interesting.
That does get kind of tiring at times, but I'm also, like I said, I'm also so used to it that it's just kind of become second nature, which...
Well, you know, it's amazing. It's interesting. What's interesting, what I remember vividly, when I recall vividly, is right from the start, I felt comfortable having frank conversations with you. I remember in the interview, I remember asking you the question, you know, so when you're speaking, you know, you're animated. You, like many people, speak with our hands for expression.
Yep.
Our hands work differently. The tone of your voice changes. Is this discomfort? Is it what? And I mean, I felt, I think I grew up thinking, or maybe I was even taught, that was impolite, right? Or that was not what you do. You don't have an honest conversation, right? A frank conversation. But I felt somehow so at ease. Maybe it was your parents. Maybe it was just, I think it was you. And you responded just really clearly about that. And you had this incredible ability as a kid to make it really clear. You can have any conversation you want with me. You may not get the answers you want, but you're not going to, it's not going to offend me that you ask me a question. And I was, you know, that was amazing. And at the same time, it felt like, geez, I wish I had been the adult in that room rather than you.
But honestly, that was one of the things that I most appreciated, because I remember being very frank in that interview, saying, I don't even want to be at your school. Like, why am I here? But, and then having that conversation that you recalled and saying, like, I'm really happy that we're having this conversation, because so many people just don't ask those questions because, like you said, they don't feel like they're being polite. And sometimes politeness doesn't get us anywhere. Like, yeah. if you're concerned that I'm getting tired because my pitch is changing or something like that, then you're not giving me the chance to fully express. And I've learned from that conversation that I have to put myself out there more, and I have to tell people, like, my speech might be a little different than everyone else's, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that I'm tired. It just means that my vocal cords function a little differently, mm-hmm. Because of my spasticity. So I've learned in the professional space that I do have to make people at ease with what they're about to see, mm-hmm. which is interesting, but it's something that some people might say, well, it's not your responsibility to do that. But if I don't do that, then I'm not going to be given the same opportunity.
Right, right. So if you don't do that, and if they don't do that, right? I mean, there's a way in which, like, you should. I mean, I kind of agree with this thing. You shouldn't have to do that. On the other hand, you know, if you don't, if they don't ask, if there's not an opportunity for you to tell, they're going to walk away with certain assumptions based in ignorance.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so all sorts of opportunities will be denied, right? I mean, or
exactly.
All sorts, and that can't be good, right? I just had this flash as you were speaking of your parents coming to pick you up. It wasn't the first day, but I think it was the second or third day. It was the end of the week, and where's Sophia? You know, her folks are here to pick her up. And there you were with Lori Stevens sitting on your lap,
yep.
racing down the walkway in your electric wheelchair. And just, you know, just like, oh, this is the right place for this kid.
Yes, it was.
And then you gave
no,
me
and I, yeah, no, I, and I, and that was, that those were some of the times where I realized, like, the fact that I was given the opportunity to be in such a juxtaposition of an educational experience, like, from the really, really toxic to the really, really just open,
mm-hmm.
I think has made me stay in education, because I want to be part of somebody's experience, just like you were and the folks who were back at New Roads back in the day were for me, where I wasn't some problem to deal with, but I was just another 14-year-old kid. Like,
yeah. You were a 14-year-old kid with a go-kart.
I know, exactly. Like, I had some some good to bring to the community, whether yes. it was like being a taxi cab for Lori Stevens or like a joke for someone else. Like I think that was the moment where I was like, this is just so not something that I'm used to, because I was for so many years just this anomaly of a kid who was very smart, but nobody took seriously aside from my parents and my family, right. because I was not what they were used to as a person in a chair.
Right.
A lot of folks don't have the time to spend hours on the internet and find those resources and find those people, and the financial stuff is also an issue. The financial resources to find the attorneys and find the things. Right. And so I count my blessings in that regard, that I was able to get myself out of a toxic situation, because who knows what my mm-hmm. life trajectory would be if I sure. hadn't done that switch.
Right. Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, I almost don't even know how to think about it. I was, you know, I was about to say, how could that not be frustrating? Right. I mean, and I get that it's not necessarily your experience, but the idea that somehow you just, you know, a person has to fight to even be seen, never mind yep. be seen and then seen for what you are, just to be.
And I still have to fight to be seen, regardless of, I mean, I've done everything that I could possibly do to, in terms of education, to have seats at different tables. But to this day, if I don't pull out the fact that I'm a doctor at certain events, people are just like, oh, she's just another educator. Like, somebody must have given, well, I've gotten when I tell people that I am still a teacher at my old high school, they're like, oh, well, that's nice.
Oh, that's
they
nice,
gave
yeah.
you a job at your old high school. And so I constantly am fighting against the, oh, you got the pity job.
Right.
And
does that come? Sorry. Does that come also from colleagues? I don't mean people you work with at the school necessarily, but other people with physical or otherwise other disabilities or challenges, do they assume that you got the pity job?
No, I wouldn't say it comes from people who are in the disability community, but it comes from other able-bodied folks all the time.
Yeah, yeah, got it.
Because they assume that the only person or the only people that would give me a job while I was still getting my master's, even though I was getting my master's in education and all of that, the only people that would give me a teaching job to be in front of other children,
yeah,
would be the people that were yeah. high school teachers.
I assume. I wish I wasn't going to say this. I assume that a lot of people at the time felt that way. When I hired you, when I offered you the job.
I remember having concrete conversations with you about that too. And I was like, look, I don't want to be your pet. Like, I don't want to be here only because I'm an alumni of the school. Yeah. Like, I want to be valued for what I bring as a teacher.
Right.
And there's still days where it feels like sometimes parents, colleagues, anyone might think, oh, well, you're an alumni, how sweet. And I'm like, but I've also been here for 17 freaking years. Like, at some point, give me some credit.
Like, give me some credit, yeah. Well, give everybody some credit. It's like nobody's keeping you around as because you're like a mobile, right? You know, yeah. Oh, isn't this interesting? Yeah, no. Right. Well, no, yeah. Although, I mean, you know, I would say the risk that I felt in hiring you back then was just, you know, you were a young teacher and, you know, and I know you would be walking in the room, not just as an inexperienced or relatively inexperienced teacher, but you have that other thing to overcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as I thought, well, this is a pretty amazing community, I was like, that was risky. And not, you know, I knew that you had I knew that you were extraordinary, but I didn't know that it would be extraordinary enough. And that, you know, there's a lot of, as you know, right? I mean, there's a learning curve that only comes. Yeah. You can't learn it all without being in the classroom. And then you're in the classroom and it's like, whoo, right?
And let's be honest, teaching at New Roads is teaching it's a whole other beast than teaching at other schools.
Oh, yeah.
For a good reason.
Yeah.
But it also made me know how I had to handle myself and the professionalism with which I had to present from the very beginning, not necessarily like how I looked, but I had to have my teaching in order from the very beginning, because I knew that if not, parents were going to be like, what are you doing? Like, and they were automatically going to use the disability as a scapegoat.
Right.
Regardless of whether it had anything to do with it or not.
Sure.
They were going to say, well, this person doesn't know how to teach. And the reason is because she doesn't teach traditionally and she doesn't write things on the board.
Right.
And she doesn't do all this. And I remember having various conversations with various parents in the very beginning, saying, like, well, exactly, the speech conversation came into play. Like, your speech is a little slurred. And I'm like, but can you understand what I'm saying in English? Because if you can understand what I'm saying in English, I'm pretty sure your son can understand what I'm saying in Spanish. But once people got to know me and got to know how serious I was about teaching, those conversations started to not happen as much.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the unfortunate thing. Like, I feel like I'm never going to be able to get a chance just by applying to a position or a conference blindly. Like, somebody needs to know me before they actually give me a chance.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I was given a chance by you was, like you said, you knew me and you were willing to give me a chance.
Right.
That happens in every single aspect of my life. Right. If somebody knows me and knows that I'm capable, they understand that, well, she's got her shit together. She's gonna be able to do everything that we're asking her to do. But unfortunately, the sight unseen situation is never gonna work for me. Because the second they see me, they're gonna make that assumption of, Well, we didn't know that you were in a chair. Like, how does that work? And so I never once have not disclosed my disability because of that. Like, because if the person is going to make an assumption right off the bat because I'm sitting in a chair, I'd rather not deal.
Are there specific assumptions that people make? Like, do they cluster? You know, what are some of these assumptions that they make?
The main assumption is that I'm just not intelligent. Because they associate the sitting in the chair with some sort of mental delay. They assume that the person sitting in the chair also has some sort of developmental delay. They assume that the person in the chair, just because they can't drive, doesn't have the ability to get places. So there's all sorts of societal assumptions.
Right.
And that, well, I'm always going to be dependent on other people, which, sure, I am to a certain extent, but it doesn't mean that I don't live my life independently.
Yes, and nor does it. You know, if anybody pays attention to that for more than a nanosecond, you know, so that this person is dependent on other people. Really? Like, you mean there are people who aren't? You mean you go out and farm your own food? What are you talking about? Like, what do you mean? Like, and lest anybody think otherwise. I had a lot of conversations when I was in the school. I had a lot of conversations with teachers about their grades being late. I never had to have that conversation with you. Not once. I was always like, oh my God.
But also there's that I always made sure, and I always to this day make sure that I conduct myself. And you hear this conversation with so many different groups of people who always feel like they have something else to prove. So for me, it's because of my disability, maybe also because I'm Latina, and all sorts of things. But there are people who will always say, like, I have to make sure that my stuff is spotless, because if not, somebody's going to judge me.
Right.
I live with that every day. Like, I can't drop the ball on anything.
Okay, so how is that not exhausting?
It is. It's exhausting. But it's become so much of what I had to do that it's not even something that I have to necessarily think about anymore.
Sure.
Because it just is.
Yeah.
But like, even like for the last few years, I've had to like take some time off for various medical procedures from work. And even when I'm technically on medical leave, like I'm constantly making sure that people understand that I'm not like taking a break from being a professional, and that goes back to my mental idea that if I don't prove to these people that I'm still part of it, and that I'm still looking out for my students, my colleagues, whatever, then I can be gone in the blink of an eye, and I don't want to be gone, because if I'm gone, then it's going to be 10 times harder for me to find a job.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
because of everybody's assumptions.
Yeah, is there ever a way around that? Do you see it? Do you see it? I don't mean for you personally, but I mean, I guess that's the work of the disability community, right? I mean, disabled rights, et cetera. How do you make a dent? I mean, make a dent in it, but with your competence, but boy, is that an uphill climb.
I mean, I see it every time I go into it because, like you said, I've now started a company with a colleague. So we go in and we have these conversations and imagine what you can then start to do in building inclusive, like truly inclusive workplaces and all of that. So bringing disability to that conversation is part of what's going to eventually solve this idea of why is it so difficult to be a professional with a disability?
Mm-hmm.
Because of a lot of these assumptions that people make.
I have a question for you that the folks broke your pelvis or broke your femur, right? I mean, it had a real impact. Real, and I use that word hesitantly. It had an obvious impact on your well-being.
Yep.
That was not based entirely in your feelings. You had feelings about it for sure.
Yeah.
But, and I think a lot of times there's pushback on DEI stuff because often it feels like the only thing that people are speaking about is their feelings. I hear this from academics. I hear it from from people in the work world. It's like, I'm running a company. I'm not here for my employees' feelings. You know, so right. Somebody. Like, okay, I made a mistake. Sorry. I called you the wrong pronoun or I said something that out of my own ignorance that you feel hurt by. And yet the stuff that happens has happened to you. It just,
right.
It feels more real. I don't know how to say this other than I don't know how to say it in a way that doesn't sound shitty, but it's like it feels more real.
But it is shitty. But what I think what the work is now is to say if you are a company that is stating to the world that you are trying to be more inclusive, then how are you going to exclude one category, for lack of a better word, that is so cross? It crosses all different types of minority.
Yes,
I think you can be a woman. You can be whatever it is. So what we are trying to say is whether you think it's based on feelings or not, it's reality. And if you as a company are saying we are invested in making it a more equitable work, if you are that person who doesn't give a damn and just rather focus in on your company's bottom line, then don't say it in your mission statement that you want to be an equitable workforce.
Well, but wait, so Wim, can I push back here for a second?
Yeah.
But we'll include, this is somebody, I'm speaking for somebody else. We will include anybody who can help us get to our goal, which is making widgets. You know, we right. want to make certain kinds of widgets. We want quality control. But it's like, so whoever can do that. And if somebody is in a wheelchair who can do that, great. And if somebody is Black who can do that, great. And if somebody is, but the fact that somebody is, the fact that somebody is in some identity group, why should I have to pay attention to that? Because I'm not in the business of that. I'm in the business of widget making.
Right. Correct. But part of it is because it's the law. Like, there has to be some version, some realization from companies that there is some law that is driving the placement of your workers in equitable conditions. So part of that is that going beyond the law, it's now become what kind of image do you want to give to the outside world? And since now it's become part of this idea of making your places where people actually want to come and work and want to be seen, just like I was finally seen as a integral part of a community when I walked into New Roads, I think that's what workplaces are finally realizing. People are much more productive as employees when they feel seen and heard. And being seen and heard is part of the work of DEIAB. Is like, what does it mean to belong in a workforce? What does it mean to have diversity and equity in a workplace? It means having the tough conversations that a lot of companies don't know how to go about because of the same idea that we talked about in the first place. Is we've been told, and I put myself in this, we've been told that sometimes these topics are taboo because they're really uncomfortable. But until we address them, there's nothing is going to come of it. And that's why myself and my colleague come in and facilitate some of the conversations around disability. But to go back to your point, I think the idea is really about, if you are more seen and heard, you become a more productive person. I was given the opportunity to show who I really was at New Road.
Right. And it was ultimately your ability to teach students, to work with students effectively, that is most valuable in the school setting, right?
I was never denied the opportunity to sit in the room and prove myself. Oftentimes, that opportunity is not even given because people are so scared of what that implies. If we hire someone with a disability, what does that imply? It means that we're going to have to spend thousands of dollars on equipment and sure, there might be circumstances where that might happen, but there's also really simple things that you can do, and just awareness-based that you can do to make an environment more welcoming to someone with a disability. Mm-hmm. You did a lot of that without even knowing that that's what you were doing. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. I think one conversation at a time, you can realize you can change somebody's, or you can have a deeper conversation with certain people. And
totally.
And those are the conversations that you're left with, but not wanting to bridge those conversations because you're scared of the outcome,
right,
is the worst thing you can do.
Totally. Well, Sophia, I am glad you were willing to have those conversations with me. And so thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.